linked to morality or not, because it really depends upon the framework you interpret them in.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we move to another topic of conversation, I'm just going to take a moment to say that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Pihak Kovacet. I'm here with Brendan Brownlee and Tegan Marshall, and we're talking today about the philosophy of law, and we're getting into some of the more nitpicky details of what we elaborated on in the first part of the show on the nature of law. So I think that's a really good point, and that's what I was actually going to say about the judicial role earlier. We could have a whole other show on that, about judicial role and interpretation. And as you say, there's sort of, again, two broad camps, sort of living constitutionalism versus originalism in here. I won't get into detail too far with it, though it is related, absolutely. But there is an account that, should we do an episode on it, I'll bring it up. It's an account by McConnell. And what he says is basically, well, he admits himself to being an originalist, but what he says is that judges essentially go through almost like a flow chart in their decision making, where they start by reading the text. Obviously, everyone has to read the text to see what it says. Then they go to, on the judicial sort of side of things, they can go to, okay, what's the precedent on this, right? We're in a common law system, so precedent plays an important role, as in what previous judges have said binds future judges. On the political side, you look at sort of practice, like practically speaking in the political sphere, what have people done with relation to this law? So it's kind of like a political version of precedent. And only then do you go to either living constitutionalism or here, let me pull up the, but only as a last resort, he says, do you go to any normative considerations whatsoever on the matter, right? So it's an interesting view. I'll get more into it at a later date if I get the chance. Right, and the alternative that he prefers is judicial restraint, where basically the judges say, if after all of that, after looking at the text, the longstanding practice, the precedent, we still don't know what to do, we'll defer to the legislature and the executive to decide what to do here. We assume it's constitutional and we let them do what they want to do, as opposed to imposing our own normative views on it. However, it's a little bit far afield, and what I want to do is get back to the cases we were talking about last time and a new one, because I want to hear what you think in an applied sense about these two views on these cases. So I'll summarize from last time. We talked about a couple important cases. The first was Riggs versus Palmer, where this gentleman, Francis Palmer, he had a will and testament written. The majority of the estate was to go to his grandson, Elmer Palmer, and his two daughters, the married name of one of which is Riggs, they were to get some of his possessions. And Elmer, to enjoy the speedy enjoyment of his father or of his grandfather's will sooner, and because he was afraid that his grandfather had expressed some intent to revoke or revise his will, he poisons him. Now, nothing in the statute at the time says that should someone, the beneficiary, poison the testator, that he shouldn't get what's in the will. He was convicted of murder and he did serve jail time, but the question was, should he still get what's provided in the law? And the problem is, the law at the time specifically enumerated a list of 6 instances in which someone wouldn't be allowed to be the beneficiary of a will. Of course, if it was not written in due process, if it was revoked or changed, that kind of thing. But it never says anything about murder. So that was the question facing the judges. And the majority decided to side with not allowing him to be the beneficiary of this will, because they said in no universe could the intent of the late Francis Palmer have been to give his grandson his estate when he was murdered by him. But the dissent said, listen, our hands are tied. The law says what it says, and it's very specific about it, too. in this instance, he should serve his time for murdering, absolutely, then there's nothing stopping him from getting the will. And if we think the law is a bad law, go ahead and rewrite it, legislature, but it's not a law just because it's a bad law.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tegan, thoughts?
I mean, having not read the case in detail, but with the synopsis you gave me, one Canadian option that exists within our political system is the idea of jury nullification. So for example, this happened in the Mercantiler case, which was a famous case regarding abortion access and all of this. A jury was convened, a trial was taken, and I can't remember the decision, but it was a classic example of what we expect to be jury nullification, which simply means that the jury did not make a verdict because they thought that the law itself was unjust. So because jury nullification is a secret thing, we never know what cases were truly jury nullified or not. We will never know. But so that idea of standing against perhaps an unjust law and changing it, that certainly is an option. I think jury nullification would be another one to say, either they declare this as a verdict, even if they don't necessarily believe it, or because they don't agree with the law, they vote the opposite. I say that because I may not have gotten my definition of jury nullification right, so I want to cover my bases just in case. But to say, in this case more specifically, if I'm to apply Ross's theory, and I see that we have a duty of non-malevolence, well, the grandson has broken that duty of non-malevolence. And he certainly has broken the duty to beneficence. What is beneficence? Beneficence. Beneficence, for those who don't know, is simply to promote and to promulgate the good of another person. So to do that, he's failed there. Some would argue, probably, I would argue rightly, that he's broken his commitment to fidelity to his grandfather in trying to kill him and get the will sorted. So, yeah. So I would say that it would be absolutely right to withhold the will from him based upon those duties that Ross presents. But some could easily fire back and say, well, Tegan, isn't that an emotional response? That you just feel as if he's done these things, so he doesn't deserve it?
Yeah, I would say my response, rather than that it's just emotional, is that what if I don't agree with Ross? What if I don't think fidelity is should be part of the list? So that's exactly the question here is, maybe there are some principles, like I said, that Dworkin identifies that seem to underlie the legal system in every case, and that those have a pretty strong claim to guiding judges' behavior, even when the letter of the law says differently. When it comes to further principles like that, what if the next judge elected doesn't believe Ross's account, and then operates on different principles and different foundational, you know, concepts and says, well, actually, fidelity isn't part of the list, so Elmer did nothing wrong, right? Which is a sort of tangential or paraphrase, you know, paraphrase of the dissent in the Riggs versus Palmer case, which is saying, yeah, like, the law says what it says, and we may dislike the law, but that doesn't oblige us to disobey the law. Nor, as a matter of fact, what law obliges us to do is follow it. And if it's a bad law, elect someone who's going to change it.
There are kind of clear rules here, and if you just check all the boxes, the estate should land in Elmer's lap, you know? There's nothing saying he doesn't get it. Sure, he's going to do his sentence for murder. What he's getting punished for is murder. I really want to try to think about how to think about this without appealing to something like principles, because in this case, we really do have a law that, you know, it goes from A to Z. It checks out. There are problems, but the problems are principled problems. We're not bumping up against a violated rule per se. So this really is a principled, this is a very discretionary matter. And maybe that's the fact that we're having to discuss this and there's no obvious thing wrong, and yet there's still something unintuitive or there's some sense of justice violated, that gives us a reason for looking into it. I mean, it's become a very famous case as a kind of intuition sink, I suppose. I wish I had a position that let me address it in a more positivist sense. I mean, you could do something like a social contract, but that's also kind of naturally theory, like that's a natural theory as well. So there is one principled consideration that I can make that isn't just trying to punish him further for murdering his grandfather. And it's this idea that as far as the facts of the case go, we know that he made haste to poison his grandfather because he was worried about him changing his mind or taking him off the will. I wonder if there is an idea of compulsion. This is in effect a way to try and compel the results of the will, and that shouldn't be allowed. You can't compel someone. You can discuss it with them. You can have a meeting and whatnot, but you can't compel someone to make that decision. And this is a form of compulsion to affect the result of the end result of the will. And that is distinct from the murder case. That is actually on the level of the will itself. So I wonder if there is, if that's a rule that could be looked into, or we can appeal to principles of non-compulsion in a legal contract.
Yeah. So I think that's a good point. Is there's another way of looking at this where, independent of sort of our normative feelings or principles about this, there maybe is another kind of principle underlying this, that something like someone shouldn't be able to benefit from their own crime, which is actually something we follow, you know, ever since then. Or maybe something else that, like, actually, like you say, the will, even if it wasn't written into the will that it should come into effect at a certain time, though it was written that it should be when he dies, but there's a certain sense in which, like you said, it's almost like fraud that he committed in order to get this will actually passed in the way that he's trying to get it passed, right? So yeah, there are different ways of looking at it. I could imagine a world where the principles that are being applied in this case, we just don't believe in, and those are contingent. And what isn't contingent is what won't be different regardless of the judge making the decision is what's written in the law, right? Which is how you kind of, you make that case the other way. I did want to mention, while we still have time left, the other case that we didn't get to talk about last time, which I think is actually quite interesting, and Tegan, you may have talked about this in your class already, but it's this is the Wing versus Angrave case, and this is where, so essentially what happens is there's a husband and wife, and they go on a boat cruise with their children, and they had written wills prior to that saying that the husband said should he die, his, you know, belongings and his estate should go to his wife, unless she dies before him, in which case they go to this Mr. Wing to hold in trust for his children until they get become of age, and if they die before that point, he gets the estate. And the wife's will was simpler. She just said, my estate goes to my husband if I die. Unless he dies before me, then it just goes to Mr. Wing. So this was a family friend of theirs. They both wanted their possessions to go to him, or at least conditionally. Now, as you might be able to imagine by the fact that the condition is that one dies before the other, what happens is the ship is caught in a storm, and someone, a witness that survived and managed to come back and bear witness, said he saw them all get swept off by a wave at the same time, and they were never seen again. So...
Wait, what?
Yeah, so apparently a huge wave hit the side of the ship, swept them and the kids overboard, and he didn't once see another one, like, bring their head up above water or whatever. They were swept away, and they were not seen after that point.
But he conveniently survived somehow.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know. There may have been other survivors as well. I don't know exactly the details, but at least there was this witness. But the point, conspiracy theories aside, is that there is no evidence that one survived the other between the husband and wife. What to do? Does Mr. Wing get their estate, their possessions, or not? Because the wills clearly say if one dies before the other. Now, there are some doctors that say, oh, Miss Wing was sick, pretty sick, a little bit weak at the time that she went traveling. So probably the husband could have held his breath or survived in water longer than she could. And so on reasonable assumption, she probably died before he did. The judges say, yeah, but we can't make that presumption. And so in fact, they do say there's no presumption under law, it's called, that either one survived the other in this case.
So I just need to get this clear. So the reason that there's a confusion is because there's a condition of if one dies before the other. So there is this question of, okay, well, maybe one of them did die before the other. And so does the estate go to the family friend, Mr. Wing?
Because the question is, they don't know if they died at the same time. Mm. Because if they did, then no one can be said to have survived the other. And then the wills would not have effect.
Oh, okay. So yeah. This kind of a hidden premise here. It's possible for an estate to just be unaffected by a nullified will.
They specify in their wills that it should go to Mr. Wing in this case.
Right.
There are laws in place that say, for example, if someone doesn't leave anything for their wife and family when they die and it's not written in their will, the judges actually have the right to say, okay, actually part of this will is going to go to his wife and family and not to who he says, like to his mistress or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there are some principles written in, but none of them really apply.
Yeah.
The idea is just there's a third option, which is that they died simultaneously, at which point, because they say one has to survive the other, the will can't go to Mr. Wing.
Right, and
they can't have effect.
Yeah, and that's the contesting party is Mr. Wing isn't. Yeah, okay. Because the doctor's coming in, it feels very nitpicky in a way. You know, it's like, well, we can determine this.
Yeah, I think they were asking professionals to see, you know, to get some information or some opinions on this. And they're like, yeah, I mean, on a medical standpoint, given her state of health and everything, and given the fact that the kids were kids, the husband was most likely to have survived the longest.
Yeah.
But they have no evidence one way or the other.
Yeah.
Tegan, do you have thoughts?
Well, I mean, it just sounds too much like a movie plot line to me that I think yeah, I think it would be hard because of, as you stated, the conditions that are laid out that one has to survive the other in order for it to take effect. So I would imagine that they would then say, instead of giving it to Mr. Wing, we'll give it to a third party to hold. That is not him who is biased to the case, but what was there... What was the ruling in that decision?
Yeah, so the holding, Wing's appeal was dismissed with costs. So they rejected his appeal. They said, and basically their ruling was something like, so the people defending Wing were saying the onus is not on him to prove anything because clearly, quote unquote, the wife died first of all. And second of all, that the will should go in favor of him. But the other side said, well, there's unclear survivorship, first of all, which is what I just talked about. And it's the onus is on Wing to prove that one died before the other for the will to take effect at all. And essentially, actually, this then leads later to what we now call simultaneous death clauses. So they do exist now in response to this case, which basically say a lot of people will write in a simultaneous death clause into their will, or like there's an assumption that should they die together, something will happen in the case of a given will. But yeah, they basically said, this is the positivist view, right? They said in the letter of the law, in the will as written, you need to be able to prove that one survived and the one survived the other for any of this to take effect. And it just didn't happen. Or we have insufficient evidence to prove that it did in fact happen. And there's a third option that they died exactly at the same time, in which case, you know, there's nothing that we can do about it on the letter of the law. But it's an interesting question, right? Because you might say, again, in a principled manner, you might be like, come on, let's be reasonable here. Like, probably one died but slightly before or slightly after the other. In which case, because they're talking about the same collection of possessions, I mean, their family possessions that would go to Wing, I mean, reasonably, we would be able to assume that he should receive it. But that's extrapolating past the letter of the law. And the judges said, that's not our job, you know?
Well, and I can respect them for that. But what I would also raise is you have both parties in their will stating, if I die and my husband or wife goes before me, this is the person it is supposed to go to. So I think he could have made a stronger case by saying, look, I am, according to documentation, the trusted individual by both parties. So this isn't just this. It may be that Mr. Wing is vindictive and all of that. He also has good precedent to say, according to the documentation as pertains to this case, I am clearly outlined as the person in the case that the kids are not of age. I just want to throw one quick line in here as well. Just a clarification on jury nullification. Jury nullification simply means that in a given case where a jury may not agree with a law, it will end in acquittal. The thing is, we never know whether a jury nullifies itself, but the speculation in Mercantile was jury nullification because it was illegal, but he was acquitted by the jury. So there was some speculation that was some little bit of civic protest going on at that point.
There's a sort of magnetism towards these, well, I guess intuition is a usual thing we go to because it strikes us immediately. Our feelings about a case or any matter that are conflicting or contentious strike us with immediate responses, the way that we would interpret things. And in the second or in the third case that we're discussing with Mr. Wing, it feels difficult to come up with a principled, I guess, response. Like, I can think of one. I can think of the spirit of the will as being in the benefit of the kids and not Mr. Wing. So he's not really the sole, he's not the true beneficiary of the will. It's for the kids' sake. But you run into these cases of open and shut cases that have rules. your sense of justice doesn't strike you, this is just contract law, that experience of not having the intuition, you know, your sense of justice kind of tickled in that way, I think that's what the positivists are trying to go for and yet account for in a kind of theoretically conservative sense, cover the bases for these cases where we do experience this. But it's hard to deny that law seems to have this one experience against another.
The strongest argument on the positivist side is that, like you say, we observe the counterfactual. We observe cases where the normative doesn't apply, or where there's simply that essential connection between law and morality seems to be indistinguishable or hidden or severed, and it just doesn't make sense. It's an under-inclusive theory is essentially the rebuttal. You might argue against that, say that, oh, the principles are there, even if we don't see them right away. Or, for example, even the laws where it seems to be open and shut, it's because we wrote a good law that promotes the good, right? And just if we wrote a good law, that's great. It works in our favor. But yeah, that's I think that's a good point. It's a good way to conceptualize the debate, and I think it's a good point to end on. I'll wrap it up by mentioning that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find us and the other episodes in this series and in many others on tcps.podbean.com. For now, my name is Mihai Kovacer. I've been here with Hagen Marshall and Brandon Brownlee.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hello, this is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, follow us on Instagram at thepeak@SFU. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.